Right, let's crack on with part two then. So I'm talking to John Watkins, the chairman, and James Hedges, the FD of Trackmate, ticker TRAK. And we have got through 26 reader questions in part one. So we'll now plough on with the next 20 questions. Okay, welcome back, gents. Question 27, and we're still in the section of questions all about growth. Now, Lear asks, he says, Paul, the fact that Trackmate have made initial inroads to the US market was referenced at the AGM in September, not, however, the specifics of the strategy for penetration the US into the US market. It would be interesting to hear further details, as whilst it's large, it's a notoriously hard and fragmented market for any player to crack. So over to you.
Well, I have some personal experience of setting up a business in America, so I agree with the sentiment of the question. What I will say is that it's a repeat of an earlier question where I'm hoping that we can, on the back of secure customer requirements, follow customers into the market and build a business where we've de-risked it and we've got some revenues to finance it. So I think it's a watch this space and hope that we are able to deliver on getting the customer to help us do that.
Okay, so by the sound of it then, there's not going to be any risk of big front overheads in setting up sales offices and employing lots of people up front of revenues then?
Well, we're going to try, there'll always be some of that, I suspect, but we'll try and minimize that because we don't want to, you know, we don't want to spend too much money before we get to the revenues.
Mm. Yeah, okay, makes sense. Question 28, this is from Andrew. He says, in what particular areas of the marketplace is future growth going to come from? What are the ideas and concepts that Trackmate intends to exploit?
I suppose it is a slight repeat of what I said earlier. We want to do what we do across more customers. We want to cross-sell the range of solutions that we now have, cameras, optimization, fleet management, and deploy larger and wider solutions to more people. And so there's lots of opportunity for doing more of the same that we have, but more deeply integrated within our current market. And there are lots of geographic opportunities outside of the UK. So I think growth is not going to be a problem.
Okay. Right. Question 29, this is from someone who just gave their initial, the letter R, has asked, can you explain the potential of the new AA deal?
Well, this is an opportunity for us to work with the AA to provide fleet management solutions of the type we've been talking about to their business clients. Now, they support about 9 million vehicles in total. A lot of them, you know, are warranty support for Jaguar Land Rover and things like that. But they have a lot of business customers where they're providing their services and we are going to support them in selling telematics to those customers with the objective of integrating the telematics service with some of their services they would like to provide to their clients so that the clients get a more deeply integrated solution from the AA and us. So the potential could be huge because there's a lot of customers to go talk to where the AA have, you know, excellent existing relationships.
Okay. I mean, have we got any sort of indications of the likely take-up rate amongst their customers and how they're prioritising it in terms of selling it?
No, I think it's early days for that.
Okay. Question 30 from the same person has asked, could you give some colour on the long-term potential of deals with Direct Line, AA, and is it Saint-Gobain?
Saint-Gobain, they're better known as sort of Dewsons, the builders merchants and so on.
Oh, okay. Presumably lower margin hardware comes first, then, this is the same point as before, then cash is generated from service revenues, question mark.
He's spot on. Yes, and that is how it works. You know, we don't make much money on our hardware up front. We we sometimes mitigate the cost of that hardware across the lifetime of the contract, but we still account for it in the same way. And so our recurring revenues is pure service revenues. There's no hardware amortized and spread across that to distort the number.
Okay. I think he's asking mainly about the long-term potential on those particular deals. Do you see much happening there?
Well, I hope so. You know, Direct Line is an important client of ours. The AA is. And all of them are. And so we hope that we do a great job for them and they will continue to use our services for a long time yet.
Okay. Question 31 from Peter. We've already covered this, actually. It's about how you're going to fund future acquisitions. So that's done. Let's tick that off. Question 32. This is from Lightning Tiger. He asks, is the sliding price of oil having an impact on your business, or is safety more important to customers than cost savings?
I think our customers are driven by all those things. The sliding price of oil has less impact on the price of the pump. I mean, it's still around a pound, isn't it? So there's still huge savings to be made in fuel efficiency and fuel usage through driver behavior change, through smarter optimization of their planning and scheduling functions. And there are huge savings to be made through better driving for insurance risk. So it's still a very compelling proposition, telematics-based, you know, data solutions.
So your product then for a fleet operator presumably sort of sends information back to the fleet manager sitting in front of his computer telling him that one of his drivers is too heavy right-footed and burning up too much fuel. Is that the type of thing, flags that your equipment gives?
Well, we tell the driver too. In the end, it only works if we can make him behave slightly differently. And so different environments require, you know, encouragement or you know, carrot and stick. And so our better-run customers have all sorts of employee engagement programs to keep them incentivized to drive differently and you know, use less fuel. We have customers where they've made dramatic improvements, and we have customers where it's been slightly harder because actually it requires work on all sides. You know, we can put the system in, but you know, management has to engage.
Yes, I see. So would they do things like sort of publish league tables internally about which drivers are driving most efficiently, or pay bonuses perhaps to staff based on how they drive? Is that the sort of thing that goes on?
It is the sort of thing that goes on, and indeed, for example, with the AA's fleet of technicians, there's an awards dinner, and we've actually presented prizes for most improved drivers and this sort of thing. So it's all around showing how a driver can use less fuel, how he can drive differently, and engaging with him to make it happen.
Okay. Right, that's the growth section finished. So this is now on to the penultimate section, which is questions about RouteMonkey, your most recent acquisition. Now, this is seems to have been quite a hot topic. We've had 9 questions on this. So the first one is from Paul Bailey. He says, can you explain why you acquired RouteMonkey?
Yes, RouteMonkey provides mathematical algorithms to optimize the routes vehicles should take, the loads that vehicles should contain, and to also manage the service engineer workforce in vehicles too. And so what they do is they with very complicated algorithms and very sophisticated systems, they identify ways that customers can operate their business more efficiently. And there can be very significant savings by optimizing how business do these things. Our telematics solutions reach down as far as we have quite good visualization software for how vehicles are doing in against a predefined journey, but we don't define the journey. And so RouteMonkey provide that extra element that we currently don't do. And so we believe that what they do is a very good addition to what we do, and therefore we should be able to sell it to our customers and to new customers as part of our selling our existing products. And we believe that actually they have customers that should be interested in our products.
Okay. So is it a case then of sort of integrating their software into new products that you're developing, is it, or existing products?
Well, it's not necessary. It's what we plan to do. They will sell, their product sells very happily without that integration, but we think that integrating will add some other opportunities as well.
Okay, and when will the integrated products be coming out? Are they currently in development?
They're in development. They will take, you know, several quarters, I think, to really get to something that we'll be very pleased to take to customers.
Okay. Right. And are you physically moving the people to work with your existing engineers and software people?
No, we've got no plans to relocate the business or any of the staff. We will, of course, set up cross-functional teams. We're well used to working across four sites, so working across five is not going to be a problem.
Okay. Right. Question 34 asks, what due diligence did you perform on RootMonkey, and are you still happy with the acquisition?
Well, answering the second question first is yes. We undertook extensive due diligence, and we did that commercially, technically, and so on with in-house resources, and we also used an independent external firm of auditors to do external GD for a company called Crowe Park Whitehall, CCW. And so we did very extensive due diligence.
Okay. Now, three or four people flagged up, and Bob was the one who I've copied down here, flagged up the published accounts from RootMonkey, which I've printed off. I've got a copy of them here myself. And they look pretty peculiar, I've got to say. Now, I appreciate these are pre-acquisition accounts, so you had nothing to do with their preparation. I'm talking about the calendar 2014 accounts for RootMonkey Holdings Limited. Now, this shows very, very abnormally high debtors of 2.4 million, which is against annual turnover of 1.7 million, which clearly raises issues about revenue recognition and profits that have been booked. Don't look right to me. So, I mean, do you plan to restate those numbers on a more prudent basis going forward?
We recognise that they were odd, unusual numbers from the early information memorandums that we sent and from the early due diligence, and we would not report the numbers in the way they have, and we absolutely won't be reporting the numbers in the way they have going forward. We will bring them in line with our much more conservative revenue recognition policies. I mean, they were audited, so you know that's you know they are what they are. But going forward, it'll be completely different. And I suppose that you know it begs the question of why we think this is a deal that's financially interesting for us, and that's basically we focus much more. Having understood all the costs and what had gone on, we started to focus much more on what we could do with the business and what the business was going to do going forward. And we persuaded ourselves, and we were comfortable, that actually the future projections were good. And indeed, the market expectation, you know, is expecting 3 million turnover and 1 million profit in the next in the 12 months starting 1st of April. And that's based on having done really thorough DD on the pipeline, talking to customers, because we were allowed to talk to customers before we completed, and making ourselves completely comfortable that under our revenue recognition policies, it would hit those sorts of numbers as a minimum. But
yeah. Oh, okay.
All acquisitions have risk, and so you know, you can't be sure that it's going to be that way. But we believe we've done everything we possibly could to satisfy ourselves that this was a deal worth doing.
Okay. So, I mean, what were they ramming through into sales then to have created such a massive debtor position?
It's much more around at what point. You see, one of the things that RootMonkey has done is it's secured customers where the customer has said, let's put this algorithm in, let's try it, and if it works, then we'll pay for it and we'll like it. And it's the point at which they decided that the customer liked it and was committed that I think is the moot point. We would take a much more hard rule on when is a contract really in place, when is an order an action.
Mm-hmm.
I always define internally an order is something I can sue the customer for, and that would be our test.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. So these are effectively disputed accounts then, really, aren't they?
Well, they're not
so
really disputed because, funnily enough, they have one of the things we did check is that they actually have a very good record of these debtors turning to cash in the end.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
There's
so presumably
write-off of those debts.
Okay. I mean, presumably you'll be making a fairly hefty provision just in case
the balance
as part of the sort
different.
Of... Yeah. Yeah, and you'll be doing that, I would imagine, as an adjustment on acquisition in the, what do they call it, restatement to fair value or something?
Well, it'll be the completion accounts. It'll be the completion accounts that will fix all that.
I see. So you've not bought it on a multiple of historic profits. That's the key thing, I think, isn't it?
No, we haven't. No, we haven't.
You're buying it you're valuing it on the future potential.
Correct. But the future potential of what it can do, built into our forecast, are not the value that we can add, and we hope that'll, you know, we don't know how quickly we'll be able to deliver on that, and so therefore we haven't included it into our projections just yet.
Okay, great. Question 36, in a similar vein, we've half answered this really. David and Gus both ask, how did you arrive at the price for RootMonkey, and did you overpay for it?
Well, only time will tell whether we overpaid for it. We obviously, you know, our sensible people, we paid what we thought we needed to and no more. You know, they didn't have to sell, and theoretically we were in a competitive situation, and we went through a fairly tortuous process to get to the price. I think it's less than they were hoping for, and you know, so you know how complicated these negotiations are, and so it's always hard to know whether we could have got it for less. I don't know.
Okay. Question 37. Dave asks, given the concerns over previous RootMonkey revenue recognition, how do you intend to ensure that the earnout is not abused or ends up in dispute or paid when it should not be?
Well, we anticipated that, you know, earnouts are not ideal in some ways. We did anticipate that the earnout rules might impact the behavior of the management to get the earnout. And so we spent a great deal of time creating earnout rules. And we hope that we've covered all the bases and that their interests are completely motivated to deliver real sales, real profit and real cash.
Yeah. Okay. And what's the maximum payout on the RootMonkey earnout?
£2 million.
All in cash or shares or
all in
mixture?
Cash.
All in cash. Okay. And what's the timing on that?
Well, if they hit the numbers for the 12 months, starting 1st of January, so not coincidental with our financial year, but the calendar year, they will get that paid in April 2017.
Okay. Thanks. Right. Now, Gus asks about RootMonkey's association with Yodel. He said he and his wife have had bad experiences with deliveries from Yodel, and it's also received bad press for unreliable service. So he's asking, is there a risk to TrackMate being associated with Yodel?
Well, I wouldn't have thought so. And I would have thought any concern about Yodel has to be addressed to Yodel. I mean, you know, I don't think there's any linkage.
Okay. Question 40, still on RootMonkey. KTM has asked, who participated in the recent £3.30 placing as no TR1 disclosures have been published?
Well, you see, there's the problem. Because no TR1 disclosures have been published, we're not able to say.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. Yeah, no problem.
But it was question... existing. I mean, I suppose the answer question, it was some existing institutional shareholders and several new ones.
Okay. And actually, it's not on the list of questions, but a follow-on question from that. I mean, are the institutions concerned, have any concerns about the fact that the share price has now dropped well below the placing price in quite a short space of time?
Well, I think, as you can imagine, I've fielded quite a lot of calls from shareholders. And what I'm pleased to be able to say is that pretty much without exception, all are supportive of the company, all are supportive of management, and none of them have said that they see this as a, you know, something to make them want to sell their shares. So I can only speak firsthand that no, I haven't had any unhappy or disgruntled. Well, I've had some unhappy shareholders, but nobody disgruntled with us.
Yeah. Okay. Question 41. Dave says that in a 2014 interview in the Telegraph, the guy from RootMonkey claims they made a 1.1 million profit last year, but the statutory accounts show a different picture, is somewhat less than this. I think we've covered this really, but then he's saying, are you happy with due diligence on historical numbers and trading and management assertions?
We're entirely happy with our due diligence on establishing what we think the business will do going forward.
Yeah, okay. Question 42 from Frank. He says, given that there was an oversubscribed placing recently at £3.30, why is the share price now below that, i.e. why are the institutions who were queuing up to buy shares then not buying in the market now?
I don't feel in a position that we can answer that.
Okay. Question 43 from Frank again. He's asked, why haven't the directors bought more shares after the recent fall?
Well, I think the answer to that question is that if we did buy shares, it could be taken the wrong way, that we're just trying to artificially support the share price. And one or two companies have had directors do that in circumstances, and it hasn't always, you know, been – other people haven't always taken it that well. And so, you know, the advice we've been given is that it's you know, happy best not to, just let the market take its course.
Yeah, okay. No, I agree with you. I think these sort of PR-driven token management purchases after bad news are actually quite toxic. Right, question 45. Now, this is an interesting one from a character called Michael Mouse. He's asked about the recent share price volatility. Is the company concerned about high volumes of shares changing hands both before and after what he called ill-informed blog posts? Have you, or do you intend alerting the authorities to this?
Not sure it's the company's place to do that. I think if individuals feel there's something to be investigated, perhaps they should do it. I think for the most part, we're pretty much, once we've had this interview, we just want to get back to running the business and keep our heads down.
Yes, makes sense. Okay, question 46, this is again on the share price. Simon asks, did you think the shares reaching £3.95 overvalued the company?
Again, it's not for me to comment, is it really?
No.
You know, the market has its gyrations and the market will decide in the end.
And final question, really just a conclusion, are there any sort of closing remarks you'd like to make or anything we've missed?
Well, I suppose the first thing I'd like to say is thank you very much, Paul, for this opportunity to address these questions, and thank you questioners for the questions, because it's good to have the chance to address people's concerns. I think I made it clear earlier, but I think there was some confusion at one point as to what we'd actually acquired when we bought the trade and assets of DCS. And we didn't put it into a separate company. We didn't buy the company. It just simply resides as an operating division within TrackMate Limited. I just wanted to make that clear if anybody was uncertain. And anything that DCS, the company now, I think, called something else, has done is entirely, you know, in the hands of the previous owner, and he's perfectly entitled to do with it as he wishes. And I suppose, you know, coming back to my earlier remark, we'd very much like to, you know, focus on running the business, doing the best job we know how, and concentrating on delivering shareholder value. And so we rather hope that the next time we can talk about stuff is when we do a trading update, which is, historically, has usually been sort of middle of April. And so that's probably the next time we'd like anybody to hear from us.
Well, I think that makes sense. Certainly from my point of view, I'll leave you alone to get on with running the business and wish you well and hope you're successful. And thanks very much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I think it's important for both people who are bulls or bears on the stock to be able to just put the questions to you and for you to have a chance to respond. So I think it's been a very useful exercise and thanks again for your time.
Well, no, thank you.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, we'll wrap it up there. And thanks again, gents, and all the best.
Thank you very much, Paul.